Love Bristol.
Love
BCFM 93.2.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with retired international relations lecturer and author Ron Mandel and me, Tony Gosling. BBC One's Double Bluff Jill Dando 20-year tribute this week was an insult to her memory. Throwing their hands up saying, oh well, what can we do? An attempt to exonerate the police who fitted up a man with learning disabilities, just as if the BBC had given a whole programme just to spread the views of the detectives who fitted up the Guildford 4 and the Birmingham 6. Tonight we make a real attempt to do Jill justice by looking at the reason she may have been killed, the motive, and those who had the means and opportunity, an alleged group of hired killers in Hungary who confessed the crime to a Buckinghamshire engineer and, he says, offered to kill three police he was in a long legal dispute with for £10,000 apiece, boasting the Dando murder as proof they could do the job. Also, the 1MDB scandal in Malaysia, £4.5 billion stolen by the Prime Minister in collaboration with Goldman Sachs, allegedly. The big banks putting their own people in power. And allegations of fascism being back in Europe, particularly in the East, and Brussels turning a blind eye in Ukraine. Not that they're part of the EU yet. Also, the Saudi nuclear reactor is nearing completion. Very little talk about that in the news here. And finally, Christian Zionist hate pastors in the United States. What are they saying to encourage the killing of Muslims? And words of encouragement for Israeli politicians from them too. We hear from the Israeli Security Cabinet, Moshe Kalon, secretive finance minister. What does he have to say about the Israeli state's biblical history and their rights? Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at noon on Tuesday. This week, retired surgeon David Halpin explains what's happened to the NHS over the last 50 years. And he's also an expert on the suspicious 2003 death of government scientist David Kelly, who coined the term dodgy dossier before he was found dead in the Oxfordshire woods. We also hear from a Bristol vegan mum who was told by NatWest Bank that all vegans should be punched in the face, so she rather spectacularly hit back. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday or download it from dialectradio.co.uk right now. But we're joined on the line, I hope, by investigative journalist Don Hale. Hi, Don. Can you hear me?
Hello, Tony. Yes, I can.
Can you tell us how you first came across the Jill Dando case and, you know, what context that was?
Well, I came across it. I used to do some work with the BBC, and I was contacted by a few of her former colleagues, basically, who worked in London with her, and they were quite concerned that she had been bumped off deliberately because of a probe into a potential paedophile ring that was operating within the BBC. This was supposed to be involving quite a few sort of big stars in the sort of the wake of the Jimmy Savile.
Okay, I better ask you, first of all, was this a ring which was just inside the BBC, or did it have tentacles outside, do you know?
Well, I mean, I've dealt with things regarding the Westminster paedophile, and I think there were sort of overlaps there and people that were sort of semi-involved, people that were being interviewed on the BBC. But this was primarily as a BBC investigation that was going on. There was a number of people that were allegedly paedophiles there, and some of the staff were quite concerned when they raised concerns to the management. Jill was obviously a very well-known person there. She was the person that everyone went to with their own problems, and so she became sort of a focal point for compiling information about some of this.
Now, I think I ought to remind listeners that this was a long time before the death of Jimmy Savile, former BBC presenter, which was in 2011. So we're talking about something like 12 years before Savile died. So that, you know, there would have been still live efforts to protect Savile.
Yes, I think there were. I mean, he seemed to be a protected man. A lot of people knew what he was up to, or the allegations that they knew what he was up to. But everyone was sort of stood back, and he seemed to grope quite a few of the women in the lift or in different parts of the building there, and seemed to get away with it. And if they did report it to management, they just basically told to ignore it. But I mean, one particular lady who came to me, she was actually, you know, following Jill's death, she was actually frightened to death herself that she would be a target on that if she sort of raised her head and spoke out on this. And this seemed to be a point of at least two other people there who made contact with me. I mean, they said that Jill compiled a list of the complaints, but they said, well, she wasn't an investigative journalist herself. She was just a presenter. And she passed the information on to her next in line. And they gave it back to us, said, you know, they didn't want to touch it with a barge pole. Nobody wanted to know. That was the issue coming out. And this lady came to me. She said, I do remember she then gave the whole file to senior management at the BBC, and she didn't hear any more back. But a lot of people said, you know, they didn't want to risk their careers by making official complaints and statements against individuals there, because they felt they would lose the job. And as it seemed at the time, you know, the male bosses just seemed to want to ignore it. So what they said is the best thing to do is just to keep your head down and you know, try to go somewhere else with a colleague, so that you know, you wouldn't be abused, you wouldn't be assaulted yourself, and you wouldn't be threatened if you were, you know, considered bringing some of this out to management.
So as someone who various of these people has come to talk, Don, I wonder if, you know, you can paint for us a picture of what you think Jill was concerned about and what was going on at the BBC in the 1990s.
Well, I think she was quite concerned that there was a lot of sort of sexual harassment going on at the BBC. Jimmy Savile seemed, well, a lot of people seemed to know that he was a paedophile. He was a groper, a sex attacker of himself. And various women had spoken out against him. Various complaints had been made against him, but they were just totally ignored because he seemed to be such a powerful person. And the image that was put across is that he was doing good work as helping out at hospitals and charity work and all that. And he was almost like Jill, the opposite face of the BBC at the time. So nobody dare risk upsetting him and some of his associates. And it seemed to be a crazy situation where everybody just seemed to look the other way and basically just told the woman, you know, keep your mouth shut, don't say anything about it, just get on with your work. You know, Savile was known there as they quoted to me, a dirty old perv. Everybody seemed to know what he was at. But again, they were sort of saying that there were links to, you know, people like the special branch, that he got friends in high places and he got a sort of a protection unit. And so nothing really came out of that. And it was only, you know, after he died that a lot of things sort of came to the forefront.
Was there any evidence that Jill was continuing to push for some sort of investigation, even after her manager or producer or whoever handed the papers back to her and said, I'm not touching this with a barge pole?
Well, yeah, she was pushing with a number of people. I gather she approached a couple of MPs to put a complaints across and sort of see where they can go from that. And I know that she did speak to at least one senior police officer at the Met. And again, he was sort of really pushing away from that, saying, you know, something he didn't want to get involved with. It was too much of a hot potato. And just, again, you know, just ignore it and get on with your job.
I mean, surely there's got to be some sort of complicity within the top ranks of the BBC. I find it incredible. I mean, how do you think that it was? It just the whole thing was just stifled. So something such a serious criminal offence. I mean, we're talking about people being put away potentially for anything up to life for here, certainly for decades and possibly scores of people, and yet nobody wanted to know. That sounds difficult to believe, Don.
Well, it does. I mean, when you look at it now in cold light today, you know, yes, it does seem very difficult to believe. But, I mean, I've dealt with sex offences, these sort of cases going back, you know, up to 30 years or more, really. And I faced the same sort of problem when people came to me with allegations, similar allegations like this. The police just did not want to get involved, particularly if it was a person of prominence, you know, a VIP or whatever. Especially then they would start pulling faces. And they put restrictions on it that even if somebody had complained, they could only maybe go back maybe 6 years or 10 years or something like that if it was a child sex abuse or whatever. And so it meant that the police couldn't really, or certainly didn't want to investigate something if it was beyond out of that sort of remit of time. And I think the same thing sort of applied within the BBC, that a lot of people that were coming in were big names, big star name people, and again, the, you know, BBC management probably didn't want to rock the boat and upset these people. But a lot of things just went by the way at that time. You know, now we do take it very seriously, and a lot of things are acted on pretty damn quickly. But in those days, it was really a question of just, I say, keep your head down and forget about it. Get on with your job.
Did any of your sources suggest, in their minds, that there may have been some link to the murder?
Well, yes. So one particular lady who came to me, this is quite a few years after Jill's death, but she'd retired since then, but it sort of preyed on her mind, and she thought that, again, if she spoke out about this, she could be the next target. She actually said to us that, you know, Jill and some other senior people there had been threatened, literally death threats about this, if they spoke out. Now, you know, is it coincidence that, you know, a few years later then she is shot dead? I mean, I don't think, you know, I think this was a professional killing as well, I must add. I don't think it was just a casual accident or whatever. You know, people like Barry George was arrested for it later. I worked on that case for about 3 years. And it's pretty obvious that he was not capable of planning or carrying out that sort of operation. It had to be done by more or less a specialist assassin.
So why on earth was he convicted?
Well, it's absolutely ridiculous. I mean, he was just convicted on a circumstantial evidence, a minute particle of gunpowder resin. When I worked on this case, I mean, the first thing I was told was to try and look at how he was convicted and to try and sort of, you know, discredit that sort of evidence. And it was quite easy to do it. We brought an expert in who said that resin could have come from even an HGV, a firework, or the fact that he spent a lot of time sort of roaming the streets. He could have sat next to somebody on a bus or on a tube. It could have been transferred quite easily. But what we found out I went actually door knocking and round the streets to try and talk to people and whatever, and everyone was sort of saying the same, you know, Barry's been fitted up for this one. And we had the local vicar who came to me and said that when Barry was arrested, and bearing in mind this was a high profile murder and she was shot dead on a doorstep, the police said that there were no armed officers involved in his arrest or the search of his home. That was their statement. And the vicar came to me and he said that he's most concerned about it. And he said basically the police were telling Porky's here that he saw the police at Barry George's property and they were armed. And so that innocently could have been transferred from one of the officers who, if they'd been involved, handling firearms, that particle could have been transferred to his coat. But
hey, Don, that just reminds me, sorry to intervene there, but how important it is for journalists to get off their seats and out of their production offices or their newsrooms and actually walk the streets, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, definitely, because, you know, the information is out there and, you know, same with suspicious characters and unusual cars hanging around, the whole thing. I mean, I was amazed when I was going round there about 2014, and people were coming out with all sorts of information that the police haven't even bothered to follow up. You know, once they got Barry George in his sights, that was it. It was shut down. And so many important leads were just ignored. And I was talking with John O'Connor, who was the head of the flying squad, and he was absolutely adamant that a number of excellent leads into the shooting had just been totally ignored. He got a very, very good lead, a tip-off from one of his contacts, and he says it was an excellent lead that was ignored by the Met, and he said the Met did absolutely nothing with it. It was quite clear, in his opinion, quite clear that it was a professional hit by a trained assassin. And he said it was he believed it was a state-sponsored execution, not just a, you know, random shooting. It was an execution for whatever reason. And he said, these people, you know what they're doing, and they are highly trained assassins. And this guy was obviously one of the same. Now, I mean, the odd thing with this, when I was going around the streets, people were saying to me, well, Barry wasn't even wearing a coat, like the three-quarter length coat that was supposed to be found with this resin on that day. It was quite a mild sort of day, and he's wandering around in a T-shirt. So how did the resin get on that if he wasn't even wearing it on the day of the shooting? You know, but there's a whole range of things. I mean, we found out as well that this particle, again, could have been transferred by another way. This, Barry's coat and some of his clothing should have gone straight to the forensic lab for testing. And for whatever reason, the allegation was that the photographic studio was nearer than the forensic lab. So it went to the photographic studio first, was photographed, and then went on to the forensic lab. And just a day or so before, that same photographic lab had been photographing some other evidence that had been related to a gun-related crime. So again, it gave an option that, again, that particle could have been transferred accidentally onto his coat at that time.
Well, look, going back to the BBC, you know, with these people that have come to you, how can you be sure that they're actually credible witnesses and not just feeding you a line, Don?
Well, I mean, we did have, there were several other presenters. There was presenter Liz Kershaw and Miriam O'Reilly. They both made allegations of sexual harassment at the BBC, and Sally Jones spoke about Jimmy Savile, who was later exposed, as we know, as a paedophile and serial sex attacker, and she said that he tried to grope her in a lift. And when Sally went to Jones, she told him all about her experiences with Savile, etc. And she said, well, you know, management just say, don't just ignore him. We know he's a dirty old perv. So it's a question of what could she do? So Jill did compile quite a comprehensive list, I gather, of all the allegations from other women there about Savile and about other people who were allegedly in this ring. I don't think it's a massive ring. I think it was just, well, from what this other lady was saying, you know, maybe six or eight sort of high-profile persons of interest that were, you know, stars at the time at the BBC.
So are we talking about, you know, the management simply facilitating this paedophile ring?
Well, just turning a complete blind eye to it, you know, for whatever reason. Whether these people were, you know, highly paid and big stars that they wanted to keep, or they just didn't sort of, you know, believe it or have enough credible evidence from other people to say what was what.
And what about people close to Jill Dando in the case? I wonder what they made of this week's TV documentary, which was fronted by D.I. Hamish Campbell, the guy that fitted up Barry George and completely failed to do a proper investigation.
Well, I've had quite a few people on to me because I've sort of written a few things and did the investigation to Barry's case, and everybody's quite appalled about this. It was so biased and one-sided, it was unbelievable. I mean, it came across almost as if, you know, Hamish Campbell was the best thing since sliced bread. And this was an absolute disaster, really, for the Met. It was a most humiliating defeat for them in terms of, Neil Everybody's Dog was sort of saying that Barry George was not the man to do it. And, I mean, John O'Connor, say, for the ex-Flying Squad man, said, you know, there was conflict within his own investigations unit. People were telling him that the majority of people, you know, thought that Jill Dando's murder was the work of a professional hitman.
I mean, why didn't those other death threats against BBC presenters, why didn't they come out at the trial?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think one was against Tony Hall, who's now the big chief there, one death threats there. But there were at least three death threats, and one at least was noted and recorded against Jill Dando at the time. I think only a matter of a week or 10 days before she was shot dead. And I think the Met were certainly told about it. And as far as I can recall, I mean, I'm, you know, talking a few years ago now when I did the investigation, but as far as I know, the main emphasis was to protect the management of BBC because they thought they were the more likely targets than one of the presenters. But I, you know, say looking at the information I had at the time, I would have thought it would have been the opposite way around in terms of, you know, Jill was the face of the BBC. She was on Crime Watch, she was on holiday programmes, she was everywhere. You know, the smiley person from the BBC. And I think, you know, she would have been the more obvious target, in my opinion, rather than some, say, unknown face as a management person at the BBC.
Well, these management people, of course, are all state employees. And you were saying about the special branch chief saying that it could be a state-sponsored assassination. I mean, basically, they're part of it, essentially. I wonder if it's possible for the police to investigate properly any kind of state-sponsored assassination. Surely the idea is if the state are going to kill someone, they're going to make sure there's no investigation.
Well, I can't understand why they didn't follow up on a number of leads. And I mean, several officers I've spoken to over the years here have all said the same thing, that there was a massive amount of information came in. And, you know, that's possibly some excuse that Hamish Campbell used in terms of, you know, they were swamped with a lot of leads and information coming in. Yes, I give them part of that. But there was a lot of very, very highly credible information that came in. I mean, when I went round, literally on the streets there, I went to the local school, just a few hundred yards or whatever from where Joe lived, and there were a lot of women there who were saying that the police had never come to question them about anything about that day. And they quite clearly said that there was a man that was there that they were concerned about because of the young children that were in the school playground that was causing concern. He was there for about 10 minutes. They described him in a very similar coat to the one that they claim Barry George was wearing, a three-quarter-length dark coat, a man of Middle Eastern appearance who was there for about 10 minutes. He took a phone call on his mobile phone and then ran off in the direction of Joe Dando's house. And the same man, the description of the same man, was then given by a number of other witnesses heading back the same way after hearing a shout or a scream or something. And again, I don't. If you saw the television programme, there was a neighbour on there saying much the same thing, that he heard a sort of a scream or something like that and saw this man, the same description, walking away. And even Hamish Campbell himself said that there was a man, a tall, dark man, walking away at fast pace from that area, and he was more likely the killer of Joe Dando. So why on earth hasn't followed that sort of lead up? That was absolutely concrete at the time, where we got at least two or three definite descriptions, which, you know, very nearly matched. And it's almost the complete opposite of people like Barry George. You know, he's not a tall, dark, well-dressed man. You know, like this. It just seems absolutely preposterous that all these leads were ignored. And so people like John O'Connor were absolutely appalled by this, that, you know, he said there was a lot of credible evidence there that was just, you know, put in the dump file, really. And once, say, they got a rest in mind with Barry George, everything else was shut down.
Well, we're in the last court of appeal here, because, I mean, it's certainly something has to be done about this, and the murder investigation reopened. Your article, Don, is called Exclusive, : Tragic Jill Dando Probe BBC Paedophile Ring. Murdered TV presenter Jill Dando tried to expose a paedophile ring involving big-name BBC stars, a former colleague has claimed, and that was written by you back in July 2014. I'll put a link up to that on our show page. But another thing, I mean, you've been obviously following this ICSA, the paedophile, VI paedophile, and the National Inquiry. How do you think it's all going?
Well, I was called to give evidence at the Independent Inquiry into Child Sex Abuse 4 weeks ago today. I was there. And it's very hard going, to be honest, because I was treated like as I was on trial. I was given credible evidence against a number of individuals and saying what it was like when I was attacked by Special Branch 34 years ago, and the pressures I've had in the intervening years since not to reveal my information about these people. And I've been basically attacked and abused by people like the Met, who are trying to discredit evidence they've put forward. The IOPC put a damaging report against me at the investigation a few weeks ago, which just didn't make sense. It was absolutely riddled with errors, and I had to respond to this. And I was able to provide 46 emails to show that I could absolutely destroy their case completely. And a six-month dialogue with officers at the Met and with the IOPC that completely contradicted their claims.
But surely this is not what the National Inquiry should be about. It should be about whistleblowers and witnesses coming forward and just giving their evidence.
It should be, and that's why I thought. I've got credible evidence. I've interviewed the head of the Special Branch, the head of the Flying Squad, the head of the Rochdale Police, and various others. And they're all saying the same thing at the time. When they were doing their investigations, they were trodden on. They were threatened by senior officers and told, you know, not to pursue this any further, to forget it. You know, or they'd lose their jobs and all sorts of things. And Tony Robinson, who was the special branch guy who gave me chapter and verse about things that happened in Lancashire and about various MPs and that, he said that after he gave evidence to me, he then got a phone call from the Met and from special branch threatening that he's not to talk to me at all, not to talk to any journalist at all. He could lose his he was under the Official Secrets Act. He was still supposed to be on that, although he'd retired donkeys years ago. He was still pushing that angle and saying he would lose his pension and end up in prison. And this is the sort of pressure that people are under even now. I did a radio interview with Theresa May a few years ago when she was the Home Secretary, and I put a plea in on behalf of three very credible whistleblowers, who one was MI5, one was the Met, and one was the Special Branch, who all wanted to come and give evidence against high-profile VIPs, but they wanted a guarantee in view of what had happened to the threats against Tony, that it would be anonymous and they would be protected. They wouldn't lose their pensions and what have you. And Theresa May refused to allow that. And the inquiry have also refused to allow a lot of other people to come forward to give their evidence at this inquiry. And so, you know, people are obviously frightened of the repercussions from this even now. And I've been threatened. I had Northampton Police. I put a chapter and verse into the inquiry in December about about an incident that happened with Cyril Smith in Northampton and in Birmingham in the 1980s. Then, just before I walked into the witness box, the counsel for the inquiry gave me a note saying that the Northampton Police were basically calling me a liar and saying that they never interviewed me, either informally or formally. And I was challenged over this at the time. And I had to, you know, give what information I could at the time. And I said, look, I can answer it. If you'd asked me yesterday or whatever, I could have told you exactly who the officer was. And they tried to turn it into something that I'd just made up. Well, eventually, the following week, we got North... You know, I provided all this evidence to confirm who the officers were that came to see me, the time, the date, and a correspondence over 3 months with them. And it proved categorically that the Northampton Police had lied through the teeth. And they'd given false evidence to the independent inquiry. And in the end, they had to issue a new statement to the inquiry just on the last week, saying that, yes, they had interviewed me as part of a covert operation by the police. And the information about this, all the records about my interviews, etc., were suppressed by senior management. That was why they couldn't find any record of it. So it shows the extent that the police are going to try and discredit journalists who stand up and any other whistleblowers who are involved.
Now, you said there something about the chief constables being threatened by senior officers, but surely a chief constable is the senior officer.
Well, yeah, that's right. But they, in effect, you know, still work for the government. They are often appointed by the government, and so, you know, I suppose they want to watch the P's and Q's. But, I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous. You would think it would be much easier now that everybody wants to get this out, and they all put the smiley face on it. Yes, they want to, you know, to see a way forward, etc. But when it comes to naming names, if it's against Joe Bloggs the milkman or a teacher or something, that's fine. That's dealt with pretty damn quickly, and these people end up in court and what have you. If you're talking of an MP or a person of interest or whatever, then that's a different matter.
OK, how would you sum up the ICSA inquiry, the National Inquiry, the way it's operating?
Very disappointing. It's on a road to nowhere, to be honest. I can't see that they're going to come up with anything substantial. So many people have been refused access to this inquiry, and so many people with genuine evidence are just being pushed away.
Now, I've also noticed that Harvey Proctor, I put this to Mark Watts last week, that Harvey Proctor, who's a convicted sex offender, he's been given status as a core participant, which has really dismayed a lot of people who were considering complying with and going along to the inquiry.
Well, that's right. I mean, there were about 20 core participants there at this inquiry. I mean, it's quite a hostile atmosphere. I mean, I was in that witness box for over 4 hours. I was grilled as though I was on trial. it was, you know, really uncomfortable.
So it doesn't sound as if this is going to get to the bottom of very much at all. There might be a few little scandals that get examined. But look, Don, I know, and I chatted to you a few months ago about this, that you think there is potential that actually the KGB, the Russians during the Cold War, have got quite a lot of information about what's been going on in Westminster.
Yes, and that's that was very strange. I mean, I did a book launch a few years ago, which was an investigation into cover-ups with the British government in terms of the spy Buster Crabbe, and he was spying on the Russians, really. So when we went to the book launch, the Russians were there. There was a KGB colonel who, strange enough, used to live around the corner from me in Manchester working when he was undercover. And he came to me and was on about all this coverage with the paedophiles. And he said they had done various honey traps with MPs and other people of interest in terms of providing women that would they'd be able to blackmail people for information. But what they found out is most of these people that they were dealing with were not chasing young women, they were chasing young boys. And, you know, they were quite horrified about this themselves. They didn't think this was going on. And they completed quite a large file on a number of MPs that were within this paedophile ring, and they were sharing information, etc. And so, you know, it led to believe that a lot of these people were leaking information from government secrets, you know, to protect their own identity. But they were obviously more aware than possibly our own government at times as to who was involved with this sort of racket.
Don, I know you're quite a prolific writer. Whereabouts is the best thing place to follow your work online? And maybe you can also give us the title of some of the books you've written.
Yeah, well, I've got a new book coming out very shortly, Murder in the Cemetery, which is a massive review of the case I dealt with a few years ago, the Stephen Downing case, 27 years for murder he didn't commit. And this exposes all the cover-ups, the corruption on the case from all parties within the Home Office and wherever. That comes out, Murder in the Graveyard by HarperCollins, that comes out in June. I've got my own website, which is www.donhale.co.uk. I've written The Final Dive, which is the one I mentioned about Buster Crabbe, and I've obviously written quite a few books, but if people go on to Amazon or Google, just put in the name for the books and that, everything will come up. I've written probably about 40 books or in total, but two or three bestsellers about basically about cover-ups.
What about online?
Well, I don't do a lot online nowadays because I've been tied up with doing books. There's a podcast coming out shortly, which is tied in with the book. And obviously deal with a lot of, Twitters and Facebook.
So finally, of course, it's not actually about Jill. It's also about the Guildford Four, the Birmingham Six, these horrendous miscarriages of justice. Even some say the alleged 7/7 bombers, some of those may not even have been in the right place at the right time. Is there anything you think we can change to make sure these miscarriages of justice are brought to a halt?
Good question, really. I think it's so difficult. I mean, there were an awful lot that happened in the sort of 70s and 80s period. Obviously, the laws have been changed from that, but it's still very difficult. I mean, the police work in opposite to what the British law is. As far as they're concerned, you're guilty until you're proven innocent. Once they get somebody in their sights, it's very, very difficult for them to prove that they weren't a certain place at a certain time. And it seems to be a fairly common thing, where I think Professor David Wilson was saying yesterday that a lot of the miscarriages that happen are typical of other miscarriages, where they pick on a fairly vulnerable person that a lot of society may not be too interested in. They may not be able to sort of give a proper alibi as to where they were, and they may be considered a bit of an oddball in that particular area or whatever, or may even have a previous sex offence. So when something happens, it's like the usual suspects are rounded up, and it's for them to try and prove their innocence, which is very, very difficult.
OK, Don Hale, investigative journalist, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
If you're an EU citizen living in the UK, you will need to apply to the EU Settlement Scheme. This means that the rights you currently have will be protected after the UK leaves the EU. The scheme is fully open and you have plenty of time to apply. It is free. To find out more and to apply, visit gov.uk/EU Settlement Scheme. Irish citizens or those with valid indefinite leave don't need to apply.
Now, we're going to go on to looking more and more at the potential criminals that did kill Jill. And to do that, I spoke to an engineer from Buckinghamshire. His name is Jerry Coulter. He also submitted evidence. He's one of those people who submitted some of that avalanche of evidence that was submitted to the police about who he believes was behind killing her.
Well, 96 is when the car got stolen, and I think this probably happened when it...
He starts by talking about how he had his car stolen, and the police actually were complicit in this car being stolen, and he started to do a long, long litigation against the police down in Dorset because they wouldn't help him get his car back, even though he'd spotted it on the showroom forecourt.
Published on Vomit, that I had lawyers that weren't getting anywhere, and that the police were ignoring... And that there were police misconduct, and the only people that are charged with investigating it is the police authority and the very coppers that are involved in keeping the lid on it all. And all this was being published. So that's when these people came into contact with me, and they actually predicted you're just going to spend hundreds of thousands of pounds in civil litigation and basically get nowhere and be very dissatisfied. But, and this was the caveat, when I met the chap in Budapest, for £10,000 per pop, they would knock off three of them for me. The deputy chief constable that was the main protagonist, the clerk of the police authority, and the new chief constable coming in, who all three of them, because the clerk to the police authority and the new deputy chief constable had all had meetings with me, lawyers, letters and everything. I'd had meetings with the chairman of the police authority and everything. So everyone knew that I was making criminal allegations, even through my MP, to the then PCA, Morehouse, of the police authority. Complaints authority. Everyone knew what my allegations were. It was that the deputy chief constable facilitated the theft of my Jeep and was told long before the car dealer even said that he'd had a break in his yard, and hey presto, guess which car is Nick's? Mine, the one with an order on it to be returned. You know, long before that happened, all this was documented with lawyers' letters, and the fact that they were pushing it into civil litigation. These were criminal allegations being made by London lawyers against high-ranking coppers for hanky-panky over a stolen car. No wonder there was only one way to go for them, that was to the wire. And so these mercenaries were prepared to go to the wire as well. They were saying to me that, sit there so far outside the law, the only way you'll get a resolution is to go out there with them. You employ us. For £30,000, we'll get you satisfaction.
They were threatening to murder these three.
Yes, at £10,000 each. The only reason I met them, the only reason I met these people in Budapest was because I didn't want mercenaries knocking on my door in Hertfordshire. When I met this guy in a flat in Budapest and I saw what they were, they exactly were what they were. These were typical what looked like squaddies with crew-cut haircuts. Most of them were Russian, although Petrikov purported to be Hungarian.
So how many of them were there altogether?
I saw five of them, all in leather jackets and jeans. Petrikov wasn't, he was different. He wore a smart suit and a black polo neck jumper. I vividly remember, and had smart looking grey hair, very suave. But at the same time, he claimed he was an ex-Hungarian paratrooper. What age was he? I'd say early 40s.
And the squaddies?
Similar sort of age.
Okay. 40s.
Early 40s.
So anyway, what evidence did they give you to say that they could actually do this job if you gave them the money?
They claimed they'd done the Dando job. They kept saying we did the Jill Dando job. They kept on saying this to me. As, in other words, you can trust us. Don't give us 30 grand straight off. Give us 10. We'll knock the first one off, you know. Then you can look at the other three over a period of time, you know. And when you've got stonewall alibis, like you're having tea with the Bishop of St Albans or something like that, you know. And the only one that spoke fluent English was this guy Petrikov, the one that was suited. All the others, well, they looked like they could storm a trench, put it this way, with an assault rifle, and that'd be about all they could
do.
Well,
I mean, you know your firearms, Jerry. Did you think that there was any potential link at the time?
Well, they were claiming that the other guys in the leather jackets were all that were Russians, and they admitted to being Russians. Petrikov claimed he was Hungarian, but he spoke Russian, he spoke English, and he spoke Hungarian. And his name didn't sound particularly Hungarian to me. I believe they were what they claimed. They were a mercenary unit that were touting for work.
We now know quite a lot about the ballistics of what happened to Jill Dando. So is there anything that you think that could link to these guys?
Yes. They claimed she was shot with a Tokarev pistol. Now, Tokarevs and AK-47s were relatively unknown in this country at that time, until the Polish lorry drivers and everything started bringing them in and selling them to criminals here. But at that time, Warsaw Pact weapons were virtually unknown. Knowing these people, and knowing they were professionals, they would have shot her with a soft lead bullet. She would not have been shot with a military full metal jacket bullet. She would have been shot with a soft point bullet or a soft lead bullet, which deforms and it flattens out and it dumps all its energy into the target. Unlike a full metal jacket bullet, which is used by military forces, which will actually go right through a body. And that is the reason why, so that if you could have casualties on a battlefield as opposed to a lot of severe terminal gunshot wounds that would take a person a long time to die. Soft lead bullets were outlawed by the Geneva Convention and still outlawed by the Hague Convention today. And so therefore, they probably would have had an awkward time matching the calibre of that bullet if she was shot with a soft point bullet. Forensics would have had a lot of trouble. If they did manage to find the base of it intact, they could find out what the diameter was, and they could probably get an idea or think they could match it to a calibre. But for them to have matched that to a Tokarev at that time, it probably wasn't even in their mind. It wasn't even nowhere near their mindset, right? And bearing in mind, they had got a suspect that they were working on who was a person of low IQ. They've got a bullet, right, that they probably found somewhere, a soft point bullet. They haven't got the firearm that shot it, and they've got a Hellfire. It can't even argue a defence. And so they've set about building a case against him. Well, that is already going on. Then, after I come back from Budapest, I, of course, am not happy with the fact that the police in Dorset will not comply with the SI and have their retired deputy chief constable investigated by an outside force, and that they're forcing this into civil litigation. And I speak to a superintendent, Jeff Brazier, in Dorset Police. He's the head of the Dorset Police Complaints Department. I tell him that I've spoken to people in Budapest that are telling me to stop engaging barristers and to engage mercenaries to sort it out. And I also had the same conversation, Superintendent Jill Donnell. I even tell her about this meeting with Petrikov. She just laughed in my face. She probably thought I dreamt it. I don't know what she thought. But we're a family that was an international family. We used to fly in and out of Japan. We used to fly all over the world. I was married into a Japanese wealthy family at the time. I had an open checkbook from Japan to pay for the legal fees. And she just laughed at me. When I reported to Brazier about these mercenaries, I even told him that they claimed to be the same people that shot Jill Dando, and he supposedly made a note of it, and that was, I never heard anything more. You'd have thought that someone from Hertfordshire Police or something, someone would have interviewed me at that time about these people that were still present in Budapest, right? But because they were working on Barry George and trying to build a case against him, no one was interested in what I was
what
saying.
What the police have said is that he used some sort of modified starting pistol.
I've seen various things. They also claimed, and the round that they've shown, or that I've seen pictures of them, was a 9mm Parabellum round. It's an extremely powerful handgun round. It's the same round that's fired by the German Luger and the German submachine gun, the Smeisher machine pistol. It's an extremely powerful round. There's only one more handgun round more powerful. It's a 357 Magnum. It is an extremely powerful round, the 9mm Parabellum. The British police use it as a standard round in their Glocks and in their Heckler & Nock assault rifles. It is an extremely powerful round. They're trying to say that Barry George converted a starting pistol to fire a Parabellum round. Well, I'm sorry, you know, I have a Section 1 firearms permit. I also have a very, very high knowledge of firearms, how they work, and ballistics and ammunition and everything else. I also am a qualified engineer, working in the Rolls-Royce aviation sector and power generation sector on obsolete Rolls-Royce engines, right? I have access to Rolls-Royce OEM machine shops with multi-access CNCs, heat treatments and everything else. I'm an engineer at the pinnacle of my profession with a deep understanding of firearms and engineering. I could not convert a starting pistol to fire a 9mm parabellum round. And even if you made it chamber it, it would blow up in your face or blow your hand off or whatever. You know, I couldn't do it. Most experts in firearms who really know firearms would tell you it cannot be done. The worst thing, forget the coppers that originally had Barry George and were working on framing him. At the trial, it was the backroom boys. These people were more responsible. These people had worse misconduct than the original coppers because they went along with it. They tried to make forensic evidence fit the fit-up, if you understand what I'm saying. They tried to make it that he had done this. They had no... They couldn't.
I mean, Jerry, you say it's fitting up, but, I mean, if you've got the lead detective saying, I think this is the guy, can you look for any evidence that might corroborate this? That's what they're doing, isn't it?
But they didn't. They tried to make evidence fit what he wanted it to do, because there was none. I mean, for example, on his jacket, they supposedly found nitro spit. They called it in court firearms residue. But people like me that shoot at Bisley and things like that, firearms residue to us is the residue that's left inside a firearm in an action and inside a barrel that needs cleaning out after the gun is used, right? What spits out of the barrel and spits out the breech when you fire a shotgun, a rifle or a pistol, we call nitro spit. It's burning particles of nitro. If you come back after shooting a match, it's in your hair. You smell like an old firework. You know, you have to have a shower to clean it out. And even then you can still smell it because it's in your sinuses. These particles of burning nitro are found everywhere. They're not just from guns, right? A cap gun will produce it. A party popper. If someone's at a party, when someone fires a party popper and fires a streamer, there'll be particles. If those particles get on your clothes, they will give the same chemical analysis as nitro spit coming
now,
out of
the
barrel.
I know Barry George was found to have just one tiny fragment of this.
And it could have come from a party popper, it could have come from anything. It didn't necessarily mean it was near a firearm. And had he have fired a firearm, it wouldn't be one fragment. You'd be covered in it. Your sleeve would be covered in it. Your jacket would have it.
But anyway, look, getting back to Budapest for a minute, was there anything else that convinced you that Petrikov and these guys were telling the truth?
To tell you the truth, I didn't know. All I know is they were so adamant about it, and they were so convincing that if I paid them the money, the job would be done, that they weren't going to take the cash and disappear over the horizon. And that the fact that they were claiming to have done the Dando job, the fact that they were saying that was a professional job, and the reason the police will never be able to solve it is because when you employ a mercenary, a professional to do it, there is no connection between that mercenary and the person that employed him. The chain is broken. So even if they leave any forensics or human hair or any of their stuff, there is nothing, you know, they will never be found. They will never be connected. It's not, in order to connect someone, you have to have an auditable chain. In the case of employing a mercenary, he is not in any way connected to the target other than the fact that he eliminates the target.
But the thing is, you're talking to Dorset Police within maybe months or a couple of years of the murder of Jill Dando. You're giving them information.
The investigation into Barry George was still live. It was still all live. The Dando thing had not long happened. And these were people telling me that they'd done it. They even told me the weapon that was used. I told all this to Brazier. And here's the other thing, right? All those phone calls in the Dorset Police headquarters are recorded. They had it all. But they either didn't pass it on to the investigating officers, they didn't pass it on to Hertfordshire where I lived, no one interviewed me, because they were too busy trying to frame. But if they said to them, oh, you're covered in nitro spit, we'd go, oh, really?
Do you think the police will ever seriously pursue the Jill Dando murder? Now we know that the person that was convicted for it was not guilty.
The only person I want pursued are the officers and the forensic people that fitted up Barry George. That is what I want pursued. They knew what they were doing. Even the CPS prosecutor must have known that George didn't have the IQ or the facilities or the means to do that. All I do know is it is a very, very good likelihood that Petrikov was behind it. Seeing these people, they were definitely what they claimed to be. They were a Russian mercenary unit that operate either as a team or as individuals. The fact that he told me they used a Russian pistol to do the job, I think would add up. And also, how the police have only homed in on the fact that Barry George supposedly converted a gun to fire a parabellum round, Christ knows how, just because they had to focus in on something. They had to put something in to bullshit a judge and a jury, which they did. You know, they didn't have a converted firearm. They had to prove something, so they had to sight a round. So what round did they choose? A standard police issue round, 9mm parabellum. Well, how the hell did he manage to convert anything to fire that? I don't know.
Well, that's, as you probably might have recognised, firearms expert and engineer, Jerry Coulter. Ron, what do you make of this whole case?
Well, I just want to comment on Don Hale's extensive interview. What actually was running through my mind is how major institutions are very protective of their image and why they would not pursue any allegations about misconduct. You know, I was thinking about the police department. They didn't face institutional racism until after the Stephen Lawrence case. And that was attributed to the dogged determination by Stephen Lawrence's mother. How the Catholic Church is for years is shrugging off any allegations about sexual abuse.
Yeah, but we've been told that they're turning the corner, aren't we?
The BBC obviously was not taking allegations about sexual harassment seriously. That was well before the Me Too movement. The Me Too movement has actually been a turning point. You know, now,
yeah, but you're talking about turning points, but actually what he's saying is that the current inquiry is really going to get nowhere.
Yes, I'm not really surprised because, again, if they're going to take any serious allegations and they're going to pursue it, that could basically open a Pandora's box. Exactly right, or a can of worms. So I think they're more likely to close ranks and basically just...
the establishment protecting itself. Anyway, a couple of other announcements. We've got Bristol Transform tomorrow. Wanted to have an interview, but we had that long interview with Don Hale about that. Bristol Transformed is a sort of left-wing activist party, or kind of actually quite fun, sorts of a number of different types of things, like we're talking about left-wing economics, about environment and climate. That is going on from 10 a.m. tomorrow at the Malcolm X Centre and People's Republic of Stokescroft, both ends of City Road, and also the School of Activism all over the Easter holidays at the People's Republic of Stokescroft. We'll have more on that next week, but we'll finish with Moshe Kalon, the Israeli Finance Minister, and you can comment on that afterwards, Ron.
Tonight, at Israel's 70th anniversary, it is important to say that for 67 of those years, the Israel Bonds Organization has been by our side. During that time, men and women like you in the United States and all over the world have pumped over $41 billion into Israel's economy. The powerful combination of Israel bonds and Israeli ingenuity has helped make so much possible. Your investments have been used to build the dynamic, inspiring Jewish nation. We celebrate this not just tonight, but each and every day. As finance minister, I can tell you that Israel today has a strong economy, leading the world in areas such as cyber, science, and agriculture. We have created a strong state which can defend itself against any threats. And, as you know, we have many threats in our region.
So we'll have to cut that there. But, Ron, what do you make of this chap?
Well, I think he was probably speaking the truth. I mean, the United States has not only bankrolled the Israeli economy, it's provided a record number of arms and shares intelligence, and obviously the political support that the United States provides Israel is cannot be underestimated.
But what about the sort of spiritual support, if you want, from the Christian Zionists, most of whom are in the U.S.?
The Christian Zionists, it's very interesting why they support Israel. I don't think they support Israel based on any kind of biblical notion that the Jews had a religious claim to the land of Canaan based on the Old Testament. I think the Christian Zionists have their own agenda, and they basically believe that when Armageddon comes and the second coming of Christ, people will have an opportunity to follow Jesus Christ, and that would be Christians. Non-Christians would be damned.
Well, what about this idea? What about this idea that the Mahdi, the hero in prophecy of Islam, is the Antichrist in Christian literature?
Well, that's very interesting, and you can trace that back, possibly to the Crusades, and this demonization of Islam, and even to this very day, you have many people who talk about the clash of civilizations as a result of the 9/11 attacks on World Trade Center.
But it might be fueling a lot of this Islamophobia. Anyway, sorry, Ron, to cut you. We're going to have to leave it there. Time to sign off now for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. Thanks to all our guests. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Our show page is thisweekoneword.org.uk. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.